Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our hosts will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our hosts will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Republic Forces Radio Network. We are back. Season 4, Episode 11. Dan can't be with us here this week, but we have got a crew that is ready to talk Kidnapped. And I'm going to just go down the line, have everybody introduce themselves. Let's start with Jen.
Hey, guys.
And we have Nathan P. Butler.
Hey, all. I'm back, getting ready to launch a brand new podcast soon, Star Wars Beyond the Film. So check it out on Facebook if you get the chance.
And we've got a new co-host. We got Jonathan. Jonathan, hi.
Hey, everyone. Thrilled to be here. Really excited.
Everybody clap.
Yay.
Welcome, welcome. Good to have you.
All right, guys. So we are starting a new arc. And I have to say, I was very jealous because, I mean, if you've been listening to the show, you know I was not part of the last arc. And my goodness, did you guys have a great one to do. The last show I was on was Nomad Droids.
Really sorry, man.
Yeah, imagine my disappointment, although I did advocate for that show. But imagine my disappointment watching these four episodes or the past four episodes and listening to you guys talk and just knowing how cool these shows are. It's like, oh, and I'm not part of that one. But we'll kickstart a new arc here with Kidnapped. So let's go down that same order and just tell us your initial thoughts of the show. How'd you like it? Jen, start us off.
I really enjoyed this episode. I thought it was a lot of fun. It's a little bit of a downward turn, at least for me, just because I'm such a big clone buff. So I'm a little bit kind of sad almost to see it go back to the Anakin and Obi-Wan and Ahsoka. But I still thought it was really fun. I liked how we're kind of delving into this weird hatred thing that Anakin has for slavers and how he really kind of loses it a couple of times in this episode. We'll get to like some of the stuff he does, especially at the very end, is a little bit crazy, a little bit unhinged, and I like seeing that because more of that progression of him going to the dark side. So, and obviously it's not over yet. This is just the start. So I'm interested to see where it goes as well. But overall, I liked it.
Okay, Nathan.
No, I really liked the episode as well. Obviously, it's not quite as deep, I guess you could say, as the last four episodes. But then again, those four weren't quite this deep with their first episode either. Having been someone who has read the comic that this is based on, Slaves of the Republic, and don't worry, folks, you'll get tons of information about how it's different, how it's the same, how it deviates, and all that kind of stuff in Continuity Corner. I don't want to overload that throughout the rest of the show for those who really aren't as interested in that aspect of it. But having read this in comic book form, seeing Henry Gilroy take that, along with Stephen Melching, who's also written quite a bit for the series, having those two come in, take a pre-existing story for the first time, and shape it into something that works well for the cartoon, I was really excited to see how that would turn out. It could either crash and burn or be something really, really good. And what we got here was something that's not only quite good, but it really tops the comics that it's based off of. It's a much tighter, controlled story, and it just kind of flows better. It's got that excitement and the flashbang, so to speak, that you would expect from Star Wars, all in one place, as opposed to drawn out the way that the comic did. So I'm very excited for this arc. I think it's going to turn out to be one of the better ones, and along with the last arc, one of the crowning achievements of the season.
Very good. All right, Jonathan?
I like this episode a lot, too. It, you know, unfortunately, it came after the Umbara set, but I thought it was a really strong episode. Now, I read these comics way back when and read them once and put them away, but I thought it was a tight episode, and I thought it was good sort of character exploration.
All right, very good. Well, you guys, for me, I really enjoyed this episode. I thought it was well laid out. In fact, we're going to get into this a little bit more, but I really like where this has taken Anakin, because if there's anything aside from the death of his mother that can make him snap as a Jedi or make really bad decisions as a Jedi, it's going to be facing a slaver, being that he was a slave. And it's a great tie into the movie because obviously that was the theme in episode one. So I really enjoyed this. I'm really looking forward to talking this one. So let's get started with the very beginning. We are first introduced, or at least I was introduced, because I'm not familiar with these comics to begin with. You know, didn't read them when they were out. In fact, the only knowledge I have of their existence is when Nathan has referenced them on previous shows. But the planet Kyros for the Togruans. What'd you guys think? Nathan, before we get started, do we know anything about Kuros aside from either what we've seen in these episodes or what perhaps we saw in that earlier comic? What do we know about the Togruans?
Really, all we know kind of comes down to this, which is to say, speaking as Roshti, who is the lead character here as far as the leader of the Togrutans go, when my people colonized this planet centuries ago, it was because we pursued the dream of a better life, one of peace. We dreamt of a community where armies were unnecessary because every being had every chance to achieve happiness. We dreamt of a life where the security that weapons bring paled before the joy that comes from being with loved ones. And we were successful, our dream was made real, and I fear we are about to lose it all. That's basically it. That we get through the opening of the comic book that is essentially, I guess, the comic's way of doing so, that opening newsreel that we get. We don't actually know a whole lot about it. They were created, not the Togrutans, but this particular Togrutan colony was created just for this story. Beyond that, there is no backstory. So centuries ago, they set it up, and here they are, kind of Alderaan-esque.
You know, that's a great point. I totally thought Alderaan, based on the description from the beginning, you know, the monologue that you were talking about where they said about the love of art and whatever else they said, that's almost a direct line from the radio drama when you had that scene that was unique to the radio drama where Bail Organa was talking with Lord Tyran, where he's saying that exact thing that, oh, well, it's nice that you have this love for art and blah, 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 but you should consider more things. It's almost a parallel type thing. So that's instantly what I thought of.
That made me think of it, too. I mean, it was Alderaan was stomped all over that colony. I almost want to say even the architecture of some of the buildings was reminiscent.
What it brought to mind for me, though, and it's not really tied in directly to the film itself. Of course, obviously, Alderaan gets blown to smithereens. But what it reminded me of was the recent, well, relatively recent trailer for the Old Republic MMO, where we see Alderaan in flames. And in a sense, that's what we get here. We get this peaceful planet, this unarmed planet, at least at this point in time, being torn to shreds. By the way that these battles could turn out and the explosions and stuff from the thermal annihilator bombs and all that kind of stuff. So it didn't so much ring to me something from A New Hope, but more from other stuff that we've seen outside of it. I think it was the Hope trailer was what it was called at the time.
I have not read any EU stuff with them, so I have really nothing to go on. The only thing I think I've read is something that was talking about how they were descended from like hunters and stuff. So I was kind of confused because I thought they were some sort of like more aggressive species, but I really had nothing to go on, so I was just kind of clean slate. I'm just kind of absorbing as we go, so to speak.
But it's true, they don't make it really clear, I don't think, in the show whether or not this is a colony, whether or not this is the home world. You know, they kind of leave it there as it's a Togrutan society. The home world of Chile hasn't really been touched much, and in fact, I don't think it's been touched at all by anybody on the Clone Wars cartoon team. So all that backstory still exists. It's just that this happens to be a separate colony world. I guess this pacifist group of Togrutans went and formed this particular location, as opposed to this being like Alderaan, where you tend to think of it as the prime world for anyone called Alderaanian. Well, Togrutans have multiple.
Okay, I'm glad you said that, Nathan, because I didn't understand that. So this planet, Kuros, is not their native planet. It's not the native planet for Togrutans.
Right.
Oh.
It's interesting because one of the times I watched this in preparation for the show, I let my two boys watch this, and one of my sons was absolutely convinced. He goes, oh, that's where Ahsoka comes from. And then even later in the episode when Ahsoka makes the reference, my people, Jonah, my son, goes, see, Dad, this is where they're from.
Yeah, they don't use that quite as much. I mean, they use it a little bit within the comic that's based on this, or that this is based on. But yeah, again, they don't make it all that clear. And you got to wonder whether or not maybe this is something where Lucas is going to go through and alter what the EU has done and say this was the homeworld, or maybe the original homeworld, and then they moved somewhere else. For now, since there's not much detail given in the show, we got to assume that Chile remains the homeworld. But you never know. I mean, the Clone Wars is sort of an ever-shifting landscape.
All right, so our initial plot point is Dooku arriving to Kuros, and in a very odd way that part of me just kind of wonders why he goes through the charade. Maybe somebody can help me see a perspective, but it shows up as, hey, we're here to protect you from the war. We're going to take your people somewhere else. Trust me, it's going to be fine. I insist. Okay, battle droids, round them up. What was going on there? Why didn't they just guns a-blazing, take them out. What's going on? I mean, I know obviously they want to, you know, put the people into slavery, which is probably where we're going with this, right? But why the little charade? Is there still some act of, hey, we want to get them to join us? What'd you guys think about that?
I had that question too. I wrote down in my notes, why were they there? Why did the separatists come there? Was it simply to round up the Togrudans for slaves? And I don't remember if that was the way it was in the comic. You know, was there a planet of significance? Was it on a trade route? Was there some other reason that they even bothered to occupy it after they rounded up all the Togrudans there?
I took it as they just didn't want a fuss, that like Dooku's there to kind of enforce things. If they just saw the slaver show up or something, they would maybe be able to put things together and see what was going on. Whereas with Dooku there, they can kind of hide it under this veneer of, oh, we're going to put you somewhere safe and just everybody come quietly. You don't damage the goods, so to speak, for this slaver. And it's a lot easier than trying to chase people down and round them up. I didn't really have a problem with it.
Well, that's a really good point, too. The collateral damage of, if I want to go in and bring all these people together and sell them into slavery, then I don't want a body count. I want to maximize my profits. That's a way a slaver would look at it. So that's an interesting point. Was it me, or was the Togrudan leader, when he was talking to Yoda very early on, sounding like, hey, I guess we probably should just consider joining them? Did you guys get that vibe? Did I hear that right?
It was certainly not very hopeful about what could happen to them. And it plays out the same way in the comic. I think the thing about, though, why he would come there and act the way they did, why Dooku would be there acting the way he did, first off, again, it's based on the comic, and in the comic, he shows up alone. The slaver isn't immediately there with them, so it's not like, hey, we'll look after you, round them up, boys, as opposed to in the cartoon, where it basically is that. The idea, though, I think, and this is something that I've thought about Dooku for a while, but he hasn't really shown it as much in this series as he does in the EU. It almost feels like Dooku is a guy who doesn't want to recognize just how bad he actually is. You know, he's the scumbag gangster going around killing everybody who will still put on a suit and go and pretend as though he's a civilized individual. That's basically what he's doing here. I mean, he's going around, he is a Sith Lord, he's killed, he's maimed, he's destroyed, he's conquered planets, he's essentially helped start this huge war. But no, he's still that great noble from Sereno, the Count, who should be looked up to because of his noble status. It seems like he's still carrying out this facade that has nothing to do with who he really is anymore. Maybe I'm looking too deep into it.
So what you're saying is that Dooku's going to go dust his tunic off. He doesn't want any of the blood on his hands. Is that what you're saying? Is that, you want to break in that song, don't you, Nathan?
No, I don't. Although I did start almost breaking into it. I started humming it whenever Obi-Wan gets up and does it to his tunic, his shoulder.
Did anybody else really like the character models of the Togruta, the differences? Even when the elder, Rushdie, all the lines and the detail on his face, you could just really tell the distinction between all of those Togruta and, you know, the different horn sizes and the Leku. I liked all the diversity there.
That's a really good point. They didn't seem so copy and paste. So we see the Republic show up. This is kind of the first time I've heard folks sort of talk this way, and maybe it's just because I don't pay attention or something, but they said, hey, it's been 10 rotations. I take it that's just 10 days, or...
That's how I took it. 10 days, it seemed like.
Yeah, I took it as 10 days. The original was 19. I think they're just wanting it to be 2 to 3 weeks, give or take. Otherwise, they're really late to the party. Help us, help us! Send help, I will! A month or two from now. You know, it doesn't quite fit.
Well, you know, that is, I would say, more normal in the sense that everything else in this series in the last 3.5 seasons has been like, hey, there's trouble here, we should go. And they're like, there in 6 minutes. You know, I mean, I know the show condenses. Obviously, they're not going to show us time waiting, of course. But you get this feeling with the events that they just teleported there, just got on the next flight out from Delta, and boom, they're there. But this was the first time I've got that feeling that, oh, wow, it is like 10 days later and they're just getting there. God only knows what's happened to these folks in the meantime.
They need whatever propulsion system R2 used in R2 Come Home.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, if this does take place like right after the Umbara episodes, you know, the Obi-Wan's division and Anakin's division needed time to sort of collect themselves, get back on the ships and head out.
One thing that did strike me as odd is they introduced these characters, though, not so much in the episode, but in the episode guide on StarWars.com, they have the little slideshows that go, in this case, you know, it basically starts by going just through the episodes. Then if there's anything else as far as, you know, concept art or something, they kind of tack that on to the end. And they refer to Darth Stenar, the Zygerian slaver here, as Dooku's, quote, right-hand man. And I'm thinking, since when is he the right-hand man? You know, he's maybe for this operation, but is this supposed to be a character that we expect to grow from here? I've never been given that impression by any of the stuff they've shown us for this season yet. I mean, is he supposed to come back somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I just got the impression that Darth Stenar was just a slaver for this operation. So, but anyway, the Republic gets on the planet, and I have got to say, those bark speeders with the sidecars were freaking awesome. What'd you guys think? Jen, start us off on that.
You're going to hate me, Jerry.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay.
They look really cool, but the way they flip around backwards like that, all I can think of is, like, you know, G-forces and wind resistance and the things spinning out of control. Just if I can disengage my brain, I actually thought they were really neat. It was kind of a fun idea with the sidecar that flips around backwards and you can kind of shoot down people. I like the idea.
I think Brent will be happy because I can't see them not making one of those.
Amen.
The other thing I liked, anybody who has heard me knows that my forum name for Star Wars Action News is Rancor Boy. And did anybody else notice that on Anakin's bark speeder, the front of Ahsoka's pod was actually a rancor?
I noticed the face, but I didn't necessarily pick that it was any particular animal, but that's supposed to be a rancor. Huh.
That's how it looked to me anyway.
Huh.
Yeah. And that actually kind of fits because, remember, there's that deleted scene. One of the first enemies, the first creatures, I guess, that Anakin and Ahsoka face, if you read the youth novelization of the Clone Wars film, or if you check out the deleted scenes or play the video game, the lightsaber duel stuff or not, is a rancor in the bottom of one of the locations they go to that Asajj Ventress sort of sets them up so that as they're trying to escape and trying to get Rota to safety, they wind up facing off with this big animated rancor that really would have been kind of cool to have in the final cut of the film. But yeah, they are pretty cool. I mean, I like the idea of having the sidecars. I got to say, though, the thing that got me the most thrilled of the whole thing from an action sequence, it's not even so much the fact that they've got the sidecars with the cannons on them because, you know, that kind of makes sense. That sort of fits with, I mean, heck, anything going back as, what was the name of the dude who had the, like, was it Stiletto? And he had, like, the motorcycle with the guns that turned into a submarine from Mask. I mean, that's what I was reminded of, which is kind of the battle sidecar thing. But Ahsoka's gotten to the point now where her agility and the acrobatics allows her at one point to essentially get up in the seat, leap off to defeat an enemy, I think it was just cutting off its head or something, and then leap back into the seat of the sidecar and continue engaging in the battle. I was more interested in all the stuff being done, I guess, on and around the swoops rather than actually in the swoops themselves, because in the swoops, it just kind of felt like a standard old speeder chase kind of thing.
And I have to say, what I loved about the sidecars, A, we've just never seen anything like that before, at least I haven't, but the fact that that car could turn around. And Jen, as an engineer, I think you could make that work somehow. I don't think that would be, you know, implausible. I don't know what kind of the speeds they're talking about, but I think you could get away with that. I could understand how it's just, you know, a little, oh, let's just say convenient. Of course they turn around. But at the same time, that's what I thought was smart about it. It's one of those things that you think to yourself, or at least I actually thought this, that, wow, if anyone gets behind them, they're toast. No, we got it covered. These babies, they rotate back 180 degrees. I'm going to zap you. So I thought that was pretty cool. But Nathan, you're right. I mean, I continue to be more and more impressed with Ahsoka's skills. I mean, we always talk about, hey, he's a Jedi. How can he let this happen? Why didn't he just use the Force? Why didn't he just use the Force to pull that little detonator out of Cad Bane's hands? I look at Ahsoka and think, yeah, that's how a Jedi should do things. In fact, kind of funny side here, when Ahsoka did the jump on the Separatist tank and just dropped the grenades in there, my son, who's 10, he said, Dad, are Jedi supposed to be using grenades? And I'm like, well, why not? So he didn't have an answer for that. That's just kind of funny, though, how a kid views a Jedi. It's like, no, they should just get in there and use a lightsaber all the time. But I'm with you, though. I just really enjoyed how skillful she is, even just getting up there with the lightsabers and just being a shield and just getting all those laser bolts out of the way. I thought that was really cool.
The animators have done a really good job with her, just her motion as well. It looks a lot more believable than it was in the previous seasons. When she's jumping and moving, you can tell she's kind of really light on her feet, and she doesn't feel like clumsy, and her motions seem really smooth and athletic, as opposed to someone animating something they think would be an approximation of that. So I feel like they're doing a really good job with her now.
The other thing I wanted to talk about is, do you guys remember back first season where they did rookies and everybody thought that those commander droids were so cool and they obviously have to be really expensive, otherwise the Separatists would be mass producing them? Don't we seem like we're seeing those a lot lately? Or are those like a different version? Because Ahsoka calls them biker droids. Are we just supposed to assume that they threw commando droids on the speeders, or is that a different subvariant?
You know, I'm not an expert in this, and Nathan, maybe you have some answers, but I kind of took it as like computers. Like, you know, it's got the same tower, but those models aren't running the i7 Intel processor. Those are some of the, you know, AMD chips or something that, yeah, they're the same face, same body, but there's something different about them. Because you're right. I thought that was weird, too. It's like, wait, those are biker droids or those commando droids who happen to be riding bikes? But yeah, that is kind of an interesting. And it might just be as simple as, hey, we have these models and we're just going to make them like a generic droid 3.0 type design. Nathan, any insights?
Yeah, I think it's just another matter of, you know, we're going to reuse the same models again. I mean, whether or not those types of commando droids are any different than the other commando droids, I don't think there's any kind of indication at all there. Although I would say it would make sense to make them something that could multitask, as opposed to saying, here's the souped up commando droids, and then here's kind of the B-lister ones that we now have riding the speeder bike type stuff. I would think that you would want to have a commando droid able to do more than just stand there and shoot and infiltrate and stuff like that. You'd want it to be able to hop on a speeder if necessary, fly a ship if necessary. It always seemed a little odd that, you know, if you're going to spend all this money on mass producing droids, why would you have ones designated as pilot droids or the infantry droids? Granted, you could cut corners here or there, but it would seem like it would make more sense and be more efficient use of the money if you could very easily swap out droids from one task to another without having to retool and make an entirely different droid.
And that kind of ties into my point earlier that it seems like if this sets a pilot and this sets a biker droid or whatever, that it might just be a matter of what programming are you uploading. It's like, does your computer need to read email type thing? Does this droid need to have that skill set to operate a tank? So, well, if you do, just upload this file and they're good to go. But
yeah, it seems like it'd be much more like, you know, whether we want to take The Matrix as an example.
I was thinking that too, actually.
Things in a, was it Dollhouse in the future stuff with the Epitaph stuff for Dollhouse, where they can just sort of upload whatever they want into their memory? It seems like it'd be more like that, where the basic programming would at least be versatile enough you could swap it out. But even then, you know, would you want to be able to have the droid swap its own programming out or its own routines out on the fly? Or would you want to have to go through and reprogram or have certain ones programmed a certain way? Like if I've got 10 commando droids and I've got a speeder bike that has two commando droids or two commando droids on speeder bikes and they get taken out, but the bikes are still okay, I don't want to have to go and reprogram two of my other commando droids and say, okay, now get on the bikes and go out there. I want them to be able on the fly, whether I give an order or of initiative, to jump on the bikes and go. The logic, I guess, can go either way, but I would hope that if these are more expensive droid variants, they'd be able to do more than just whatever specific single task they'd be created for.
So these, in your mind, are kind of like, to pull from another franchise, the Terminators, which can, that has everything in their memory, and they could just pull up certain files to meet the needs at the moment.
Yeah, I would hope so, but there's no canonical background as far as I know when it comes to that. I don't think the commando droids have really been dealt with in any detail. Maybe it will be in that Essential Guide to Warfare that Jason Fry is putting out soon.
Okay, so our heroes make it through what is relatively a minor little scrap. They don't really have a whole lot of problems dealing with these commando biker droids. They lose a couple people, a couple bikes, what have you, take out a tank, etc. But when they get to the base for the Separatists, it's Darth Dinar, who I affectionately refer to as Wolverine in my notes because of his haircut, and he's there wanting to negotiate. What did you guys think of him in terms of a character, the model, just initial thoughts?
I thought he was really interesting. I was very confused by his references to his culture and his people and how the Jedi had ruined everything, because I don't think I've at least have never heard anything about this. I was a little bit confused by that. Maybe there's something that it's in continuity corner that we can go over that will clear things up for me. But I was a little bit having some difficulty with some of his exposition just because I felt like it came kind of out of left field. But for the most part, I thought it was actually really interesting. This is a guy who has completely different morals than just about anybody else we've seen. He's not necessarily considering himself evil, but this is the way his people have always done things, and he's very unhappy that the status quo changed, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
See, I didn't have really a problem with his animosity toward the Jedi, because you kind of figure, even if this happened a couple of generations ago, you know, you have, you know, parents telling their children that, oh, well, you know, the reason that things aren't as good for us now as they were before is because the Jedi took it all away from us. And, you know, we blame the Jedi for everything. So this is sort of deep-seated, ingrained hatred could have developed over time.
Well, what we've got as far as continuity goes for them in the background, this is another of these that you've got a little bit of background to them. I mean, we'll go into actually one of our voicemails asks about the Zygerians specifically and where they came from. So we'll go into the backstory of them a little bit there, at least as far as reality, where they came from in source books and such. But according to Henry Gilroy, who wrote this storyline and wrote the comics, this is the way he put it in the second issue of the comic. He's having Yoda tell it here, so excuse the syntax. But according to Yoda, thrived on Outer Rim slave trade for centuries did the Zygerian civilization, moved from system to system, abducting primitive beings to enslave for profit, even into the systems of the Republic. In order to cease, resist did the Zygerians, crush their empire of bondage, not going to say anything, did the Jedi. Ruined were these slavers, but refused they did to change their ways. Into obscurity they fell, but they still practice the slave trade in the far reaches. I fail to see how they're connected to the people of Kyros. It sounds like this is another of these, well, A, it's backstory being created out of some relatively obscure EU stuff very early on for the comic and then spinning off into the cartoon. But in a broader sense, it fits a little bit more with what Lucas had going on, at least back in, say, The Phantom Menace, about how slavery, yeah, it's been outlawed, but far, far out there, it's still going on. You know, the Republic, in a sense, quote-unquote, doesn't exist out here. That wherever it is the Zygerians were operating or are still trying to operate, they're operating enough on the fringes that it's not going to be something the Republic, especially in a time of war, is going to be willing to really act upon. I mean, slavery, even in the broader Star Wars universe, within the Star Wars Expanded Universe stuff, is only really being dealt with as a major plot point more recently in the Fate of the Jedi books. And I mean, we're, what, 30, almost 35 years into the saga at this point. So it's a rarely touched upon one, and the reason they give for why it's so rarely touched upon is that for the most part, barring, say, Twi'leks and such, it's pretty far out there on the fringes where you're not going to see it on an everyday basis.
Well, and that gets us into a really good theme, and I alluded to this earlier with Anakin. Before Obi-Wan enters to even interact with Darth, you have this moment where we see Anakin react very strongly once he realizes it's the Zygerians. What did you guys think about that in terms of really a character moment for Anakin in this cartoon?
Well, given his history, I can certainly understand, and it's not unexpected that he would have that type of a reaction to the idea of slavery and the idea of slavers. But correct me, at that point, are we to assume that all Zygerians are slavers? So he sees them, he makes a broad generalization that, oh, this guy must be a slaver, so I must hate him, and that's what this is all about?
Well, in theory, their civilization was the basis of the so-called Zygerian slave empire. So if nothing else, at least a big chunk of their culture was based on it at some point.
But we're not sure how long ago that was. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. But, you know, he certainly was in touch with his feelings when he saw that.
I mean, if nothing else, by now he certainly understands why the Zygerians are here and what they're doing at this plant. So I think he's certainly not jumping to any conclusions about at least the ones that he knows he's going to have to deal with here being slavers. In fact, I think it's really interesting when they say, hey, send up Kenobi, we'll talk surrender. Anakin's just like, forget it, I'll deal with him. Just give me a couple minutes, I'll be right back. And part of me kind of would like to have seen that. That would have been an interesting take on the show, too. But
one thing about that scene, though, that resonated for me, it seems like, yeah, he's jumping and getting angry very quickly at this point. I mean, kind of uncharacteristically quick, given the way we've seen him previously in the show. Like, his darkness tends to show itself a little more subtly a lot of the time. And yet here, it's just, like, right into the anger. But what I would say, though, is that he certainly has not just an aversion towards slavery. I mean, you got to figure that Anakin psychologically connects the death of his mother with slavery. Granted, she wasn't a slave at the time that she died. But the only reason he did not get her off the planet when he left initially And the reason why he couldn't just go back and get her anytime he wanted to after becoming a Padawan is because of those slavery bonds that kept her there on Tatooine. So I've got to feel like it's probably not just a slavery angle here. Yes, that's a big part of it. But he's got to be balling up all that anger, all that hatred over the death of his mother into that to be able to give us such a very quick, visceral, angry reaction. Again, maybe I'm reading too much into it. Maybe they're not intending it. But if there's any kind of subtext to it at all that could justify that much anger that quickly, I don't think just slavery as a practice could do it. I think you need to add in the mother's death into it.
Moving on. We do see that Mr. Dinar is wanting to negotiate a surrender. But of course, it's Obi-Wan's surrender, and his task right now is to bring Obi-Wan to Count Dooku on his knees. But in a mustache-twirling moment, oh, but wait, I have bombs all throughout the city. What'd you guys think about that setup and where that's going?
I really liked when he set off the first bomb. I just thought that was just completely evil, and I loved it. I mean, it made him seem like, okay, you know what? You mess with me, and this is what's going to happen to you.
I felt like he was kind of generic, and he wasn't bad. I kind of liked his fight with Obi-Wan, where Obi-Wan's trying to buy time and just letting him kick the crap out of him, to the point where he has black eyes at the end of the episode. I actually thought that was kind of neat. But as far as the character himself, he was okay. I feel like he was not very bright in terms of he really let Obi-Wan pull one over on him. I feel like he probably should have been a little bit more careful or noticed something more, but he was okay. I thought he was much better than some of the other villains we've seen.
You know, heck, compared to some of the other villains, at least he's able to mess Obi-Wan's hair up, as I think some of our voicemails point out. Yeah. The few episodes where the character's hair actually moves. But, I mean, he is a big step up from, again, the way the comic played out, because the enemy there isn't even a slaver. It's just, it's a really poor way that it plays out in print. And at least in this case, I was bolstered by the fact that at least he is a slaver. He is tied into this broader storyline that we're going to see through these three episodes. And, you know, they're playing on a ritual from his culture, you know. They're going to do this one-on-one fight because that's what the culture does. Which, again, is not handled as well in the comic. It's almost like Henry Gilroy went back when creating this and said, what were the problems? What were the weaknesses I had when I wrote this the first time around? And now with Melching, he's able to go back and fix those mistakes. So, I mean, it worked. I do have to wonder, though, you know, was this always intended as a bluff? And obviously there's no way for us to know. But was it always intended as a bluff? Because they've got all these explosives around, and he's acting as though, I will blow these up and kill all the people that we're holding. Only the people they're holding are already off the planet in the first place. So you have to wonder, did they set these up while they were still moving the slaves out, just in case the Republic showed up quickly enough that they could use them essentially as hostages? Or was this always meant to be a bluff? And if so, it's kind of an overboard bluff, in a sense, a little more than is necessary, hence the mustache twirling, I suppose.
Unless it was cover, they were going to blow it so that, you know, the whole city was destroyed and that nobody, either the Republic wouldn't figure out that all the colonists were gone, or that it would take them a while to do so, and then they could be off and done what they, you know, sell them into slavery, what have you, whatever we're going to see in the next episode.
Yeah, in fact, it might have been Dinar just, I've got this that we're going to use for some other purpose, because right before Obi-Wan enters the room, they inform Dinar that the last shipment has arrived, or the last shipment has left, however he worded it. And when I first watched the show, I didn't really gather what he was talking about, the last shipment. I mean, to me, it could have been anything. I mean, I just didn't pay it any attention. But then later, when we find out what we find out, that it's like, oh, last shipment, that's the last cargo of slavers. So at that point, Dinar knows they're all gone. So I gathered that it was, hey, that is why we had all the bombs there, because we would have killed them all if somebody tried to stop us. But it took him so long to get here, we got him out of the way anyway. So Dinar is kind of bluffing in the sense that, oh yeah, I'll blow him up, I'll do it. It's not really going to hurt anything, but I don't need to tell you that.
Part of me almost felt, and I know I do the history references from time to time because, hey, I'm a history teacher outside of here, but it kind of felt to me almost like the Spanish Civil War stuff, where Hitler had these new weapons he wanted to put out there in warfare, but he didn't want to do it himself because it would bring down the attention of the world. So some of these weapons he allowed Francisco Franco to use within the Spanish Civil War. And it's interesting because here we've got these thermal annihilator bombs, these giant bombs that we haven't seen before. And rather than doing like the comic and having a destroyer droid be what pins down Anakin and Ahsoka, it's these sniper droids, or these sharpshooter droids as the concept art labels them, which is a new type of variant on the droidica that we've seen before. So it's kind of neat that we see these new things, but they're using the situation where it seems like they may not have been necessary in the first place. You got to wonder if maybe this is one of those, you know, testing ground situations. Just in case they show up, here's some new weapons to try out and see how they hold up for later use. Again, there's no way to know. It's just a matter of conjecturing why would they do it this particular way.
Now, I have to admit, when I first saw this episode, I was distracted for a moment when they were talking about let's fight, okay? Did they make any sort of deal that Obi-Wan couldn't use his force powers? Was that explicitly stated?
No, all Dinar said is that, oh, you're willing to fight me unarmed. I think so. He says something to that effect. But it was never stated that Obi-Wan couldn't use the force powers. I think he did it just to be a punching bag to, you know, buy Anakin time.
Yeah, because what went through my head was, oh, I must have missed that, because why isn't he? Because, you know, we've seen that in, X-Men, for instance, comes to mind where, and this is a really obscure reference, but I'll use it anyway. You know, in the mid-90s Fox X-Men series, when Storm and Callisto are battling over the Morlocks, they specifically say, you can't use your powers, you can't use your weather powers or whatnot. So they just, like, fight, you know, with the staffs. And that's kind of what it felt like. It's like, well, hey, I'll make you a deal. Let's fight. You don't use your force powers. I'll tell my droids to back off, and you and I are just going to go, you know, ultimate fighting in the middle of the octagon here. And, oh, by the way, apparently I'm 10 times stronger than a human. I'm just going to throw you around like a doll.
I can't believe you just referenced X-Men and UFC in the same reference.
I already established that the character, Darth Sinar, looks like Wolverine, so
yeah, this is
kind
true.
Of a natural fit for me.
This is true. And the way that I looked at it was, it's kind of twofold. On the one hand, yeah, he's buying Anakin time, which is at least, it becomes more obvious as the scene plays out here. It doesn't do so well in print in the same regard. It makes it kind of iffy. But just from the standpoint of, you know, if you're talking about an honor-based culture of some kind doing these one-on-one battles, you would think that unarmed would have to mean no force powers. You know, unless the other side has something equivalent. I just kind of took that as it was just assumed, of course, if it's going to be one-on-one, a physical fight, then of course he can't use the force powers, because to a Jedi, that's essentially the same thing as being armed. I didn't really see anything odd about it. At first, I was expecting him to use them, but then I was like, oh, okay, they're going for the real one-on-one, hand-to-hand kind of combat thing here. But it didn't really seem too odd to me. It didn't seem like they jumped some kind of logic leap here that they shouldn't have.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm not saying it's necessarily illogical, but it's one of those things that, to me, unarmed is like, okay, your droids don't shoot me, I don't use lightsabers. It'd almost be like Obi-Wan saying, well, I won't use force powers, but don't use all that strength you got. You know, it's just like such a natural part of him. Because, you
it's
know,
one hand tied behind my back.
It's like, wait a minute, are you left-handed or right-handed? Okay, tie that one behind, yeah. But because at the end, when Obi-Wan realizes, okay, they disarmed the bombs, now I'm going to use my force and crush all the droids, and okay, now I got my lightsaber, let's you and I, you know, talk business here. So I just kind of was wondering if I missed something. Apparently I didn't. But yeah, I caught the unarmed part. I got that. So what do you guys think about that? Because, I mean, just the little UFC fight there, because I was just thinking, dang, Obi-Wan is getting the freaking crap kicked out of him to the point that I challenged the notion that he could have possibly survived all that. This reminded me of a longer version of his brief little fight when they were unarmed against Grievous at the landing platform where Grievous's ship was at.
Now, I think I'm right there with you, Jerry, in that, well, in a sense, I was disbelieving for a moment until it becomes more obvious that he's just buying Anakin time. Part of me was thinking, how is he going to get through this without, you know, being limping half the time without a medical droid or something? But the other part was, wow, really? Obi-Wan being beaten up this badly? I felt like that element of it wasn't particularly believable. I mean, I guess I kind of blocked out the whole hand-to-hand with Grievous thing because of how underpowered Grievous felt in Revenge of the Sith. But it struck me more as, wait a second, how is he getting his butt kicked? Oh, he's buying time. That kind of thing.
Maybe that's where he was using the Force powers, you know, kind of cushioning the blow so he wasn't taking as much damage.
Yeah, see, that was my thing. I was just wondering how he could have, and I know this is a cartoon, but like in a real ultimate fighting contest. You know, one guy can knock someone out in 30 seconds because if you take the one blow just right, you're done. And I felt like Obi-Wan took like a dozen of those one blows.
But if Dinar's throwing him across the room, I mean, there's no reason why he couldn't use the Force to sort of slow his descent and, you know, not hit quite as hard, not hit hard enough to make Dinar believe that he's doing it without, you know, really causing internal injuries.
I suppose that's true.
I'm just being an apologist.
But it does perhaps give us a glimpse that Obi-Wan perhaps is more skilled than we often give him credit for as far as hand-to-hand stuff. Because being able to fight and try to win is one thing. But purposely making yourself take blows in a way that's not going to just flat out incapacitate you, and essentially almost purposely opening yourself up at times. If you are a skilled fighter, that's such an unintuitive thing. It's almost like, for instance, if I give my students a test, and it's like, say, 30 questions, and they miss every single question, you almost have to have purposely done that, you know? And that takes skill just like knowing it all in the first place, to avoid the right answer every time.
And Obi-Wan wasn't completely helpless. When Dinar's got him pinned against the desk and he gets the first call from the battle droids, Obi-Wan quite easily kind of flips him over and uses his head to bash the communication device. I mean, so I never got the impression that Obi-Wan was quite as helpless as he was making himself out to be.
Very good point.
It was really apparent, I thought, because as soon as he gets any word from Anakin at all, he just beats the crud out of him. So maybe I just didn't read into it as much. I just assumed from the get-go that he was buying time.
Now, going back to some of the simultaneous events there, Nathan, you had mentioned these new sniper droids. Obviously, Anakin and Ahsoka go through and they take out the bombs. They get to those last two, and we get this new droid type. What do you guys think about that? Because, you know, one thing that I always think is fun about pointing out in these shows is just when we see new characters or creatures, for lack of better words, obviously they're droids, but, you know, this is kind of a brand new thing. I thought it was kind of cool. And, you know, again, if Barent was here, I'm sure he'd be clamoring for the figure, and I don't blame him. This was kind of a neat concept. What did you guys think about that?
Well, I really enjoyed the new design. When you first hear them, you just figure, oh, well, they've just got some destroyers up there. But I really thought that the design was cool, and I wish that there was. And maybe I'll have to go on StarWars.com to see if there's like a better, you know, diagram picture of them, because I thought they were neat.
I always love seeing analogs of actual like war equipment and positions that are filled by soldiers in war in the show, because that makes it more real to me. So seeing snipers, I thought was really, really cool. I liked them. I hope they're not a one-time thing. I hope we see them again.
You also have the element here where they've got the sniper blaster, but then you've got that shield sort of up in front. It's essentially like a roving turret kind of thing, where usually behind the gun, you would have the person operating it. Here, any important circuitry is all behind that shield, with only the turret itself, only the barrel pointing out to attack the enemies. What I thought, I was sort of like Jonathan, I initially thought, are those just destroyer droids? Is it a destroyer droid that's deploying itself differently? It almost looks like somebody got a Lego set of a destroyer droid or a model kit, some assembly required, and just mixed up the pieces. On the one hand, it looks cool because you can almost automatically say, aha, that must be from the same people who created these other ones. That must be a Colicoid manufactured weapon. But at the same time, I was kind of sitting there thinking, couldn't they have been a little more original with it? So I'm kind of torn between that. Hey, it's cool, it's familiar, but at the same time, it seems so much like a destroyer droid that I've got a feeling a lot of people are going to just assume it's the same thing as we've seen before.
But in war, wouldn't you assume that they would use some universal parts to make, so you don't have to, I mean, the Separatists having majority of a droid army, they're going to have to carry repair parts and other things. If you have your army sharing parts across different models, then you have to carry fewer parts with you.
Well, yeah, that's part of what made Eli Whitney such a big deal whenever he started creating interchangeable parts for things like rifles and whatnot. I guess we're so used to anytime they want to come up with something new, they usually do something that's pretty outlandishly new. It doesn't really lend itself to previous droid types, that I guess I was expecting that if they're going to introduce something new, it'll be a little bit more varied from what we had seen.
But it does make me wonder, did the Separatists run out of funding before episode 3? Because where the heck did all these go?
Yeah, I guess maybe one thing that happened was that the Separatists realized how easy they were to take out because, you know what, we really should have closed off the sides.
We got to figure also, there's always that universal retcon that you could use, which would be to say, if the Separatists become too powerful or the Republic becomes too powerful relative to the other side, then it doesn't give the Chancellor and Dooku the ability as the Sith Lords to manipulate it into such a stalemate that it only ends when they want it to end. So, you know, maybe if you do introduce something really cool like this that could be very useful, all you have to do is shield the sides, perhaps. No, can't do that. Too effective. Let's come up with some bogus, maybe financial excuse not to use it and stick with the stuff that we know will keep the stalemate going for as long as we need it to, until Anakin essentially is ready to become the new Dark Lord of the Sith, apprentice with Sidious.
And see, Sidious has got such an easy way of doing that. All he needs to do is orchestrate some major blow to the banking clans, like, oh, well, shoot, there went a bunch of our money. Or, hey, Anakin, I found out where the manufacturing plant for the sniper droids are. You got to go take it out. Oh, okay. Man, the Chancellor gets the best intel.
Earlier, right after Anakin throws a little hissy over seeing the Zygerian, Obi-Wan gives Ahsoka a bit of Anakin's backstory. Does anybody think that it was really appropriate for him to share that information?
You know, the Jedi are like one big family. It's cool.
But he chose not to share that with Ahsoka. He made a very big point of not sharing that with Ahsoka. And it's almost like a violation of trust that Obi-Wan did share it and then proceeded to tell Anakin's Padawan to kind of keep an eye on that.
I don't, maybe your guys' parents are nicer than mine, but my parents, my mother in particular, will spill anything without, and there's like no filter on the brain to mouth thing. So I took it almost as like a, since Obi-Wan was Anakin's master, a kind of, well, he's, you know, he's mine. I can kind of tell him this, I know all this stuff. And this is his, like, almost like a grandchild almost kind of behavior where he's not going to tell, but you need to know. And so I'm going to take it upon myself, and almost like a parent thinking they know better. And I think still there are some times where Obi-Wan still thinks he knows better than Anakin. And so if it had come from somebody else, like if Yoda had said that to Ahsoka or Plo Koon or something, I feel like that probably would have resonated as really, really inappropriate. But the fact that it came from Obi-Wan, who's always kind of, I know best, I feel like it was actually pretty natural. I thought it worked pretty well.
And he's also, of course, I mean, he's trying to make sure that Anakin's going to be okay. I mean, he just saw Anakin have an outburst of anger. And of all people, Ahsoka is someone who can keep an eye on Anakin and tends, at least recently, to be able to be sort of a calming influence for him. It is handled kind of abruptly, though. In the comic, what you get is Obi-Wan says, I'm afraid one doesn't need the Force to sense his feelings about the subject of slavery. Anakin has never told you about his years before coming to the temple, has he? He was raised as a slave, Ahsoka, to which she replies, a slave? That explains a lot. I can't imagine what it was like. But then Obi-Wan gives sort of a sense of his motives in telling her and says, ever since I've known Anakin, he struggled to put that part of his life behind him. He must get past it eventually. Perhaps now is the time. Almost like saying to Ahsoka, you know, we both care about him. We both know he's going to go through a lot on this. You and I together can help him come out okay on the other side. Almost a sense, if you want to take it from a mental health professional standpoint, instead of it being a matter of someone breaching confidentiality to a third party, more like I'm bringing in another consultant on this particular case. Together we share this patient's background to make sure they're going to get the best care possible, if you want to make the analogy.
Ah, but speaking as the mental health professional, if you're going to bring in a third party, typically it is best practice to get consent for that beforehand. I mean, and I completely see all your points, and I understand why it's valuable for her to know, but I was just bringing it up.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a battlefield decision. Once Obi-Wan sees how easy Anakin could snap at something like that, it's almost Ahsoka's best interest that she knows, because it's like, oh, by the way, you've got a ticking time bomb here, and Ahsoka, you might find yourself in a situation where you need to defuse that bomb. Here's the background. And, you know, it's probably not a thing that Anakin, quote unquote, shared with Obi-Wan in confidence. I mean, everybody in the freaking Jedi Order knows about it because, hey, Qui-Gon's here with this slave kid that he says is the chosen one. It's like, oh, you know. But, hey, Anakin should just count himself fortunate that Obi-Wan didn't mention anything about, you know, the bedwetting problems that he had when he was like 14. I mean, that would have been really embarrassing.
Nice. Well, to make another parallel with Jonathan's point here, though, I mean, I'm a teacher, And we deal with the whole issue of academic confidentiality, you know, which parents can you tell of this, which is a custodial parent, which is not, and those types of issues. But at the same time, we are constantly being told to collaborate with other teachers when you see a student who is having behavioral trouble, when the student is falling behind on their grades. I mean, you can't tell the non-custodial parent what the student's grade is, but you can tell other teachers who have that student what their grade is in your class as a means of together trying to do something to help that student. I think I guess I'm in a field that deals with the confidentiality stuff in a different way when it comes to collaboration, where you wouldn't have to ask the parent or the kid, hey, can these other teachers and I collaborate to help the student? So maybe it's just a different level of confidentiality that I'm used to than what Jonathan's used to, and certainly what apparently Obi-Wan is used to, because he's just tossing out dirty laundry all over the place.
Well, that would make sense, because, I mean, when you think about it, Ahsoka, it's an education, so I can see that.
And, of course, we were told all of the last arc that, you know, Pong Krell was just a bad substitute teacher.
All right, so moving on, Anakin and Ahsoka take care of all the bombs. Well, so we think. Obi-Wan decides that, you know, he's gotten his face smashed in enough, he's bought enough time to end this. But there's one bomb left, and it's on a tactical droid that even I almost felt sorry for. You know, you got this poor little droid saying, how could you do this to me? And even begging Obi-Wan to get the bomb off. I'm sorry, not a major plot point, but that was kind of funny. That was the kind of humor that I enjoy seeing in the show, even though the poor little thing did get blown up.
Oh, that was hilarious. Later in there, some of the attitude of the droid. Did you notice that when the battle droid reported to him that all the bombs in the city had been destroyed, he's kind of like rubbing the back of his head, like he'd be mad at pushing down his hair, like, I don't know how to tell you this. I've seen that motion times, but it's like he's sort of patting down his hair as sort of like a stress reaction.
Yeah, you might want to sit down for this one, yeah.
We were just cracking up at all the lines that almost felt like they were ad-libbed for the droid. I'm sure they were actually scripted, but stuff like that get it off, was cracking us up as we were watching this.
I think it was something about the monotone droid voice still freaking out that made it just... I usually hate the droids. I usually cannot stand them. And even the battle droids, like, Sarah, you're not going to believe it. That drove me nuts. But this poor guy, I actually did feel bad for him, especially when he gets tossed out the window and explodes. But something about his voice, get it off, it was just funny. I was laughing in my seat.
And kudos to Matthew Wood. You're so right. It was done well, but still in the monotone voice. So it's like it didn't break character. You know, it wasn't a Toto 360 type thing. It was still in that tactical droid monotone, but that's part of what made it so funny. So yeah, kudos. That was great. So Darth Sinar gets away. That's okay. Anakin and Ahsoka are on his tail. They get on a ship. They get in a ship. And dear God, all the weird stuff they got to battle in there.
The Blixus.
Yeah. I have to admit, by this time, you know, we've talked about episodes in the past where we're like, oh, wow, you know, it's 20 minutes into this. There's got to be a ton of more stuff. They couldn't possibly wrap this up in 90 seconds. Oh, hey, look, they wrapped it up in 90 seconds. I was getting to the point to where it's like, wow, it seems like so much has happened. Has it not been 22 minutes yet? Oh, God, now they're going to fight through this octopus-like creature on a ship. And I really thought, at that point, I thought, it's like, come on, get on with it, get to wherever this is going for this one episode, get there. But I really didn't think that Ahsoka was just going to go in there and take Darth so easily.
I was having eerie flashbacks of the Trandoshans, you know, where she gets aboard that slaver ship in that case, or I guess sort of slaver ship, the catching the prey for the hunt ship. And, you know, there she is kind of going around fighting against the leader there inside the ship there. And then eventually on the hunting lodge where she winds up inside the main room. It's striking that now we get to see Ahsoka being the one that oftentimes is the one in a confined space taking on an enemy. And a lot of times when we saw that early on, it was something like her against Ventress or her against Grievous. And she was going to be driven back, you know, or something was going to interrupt the fight. And nowadays, we get to actually see her hold her own in situations like that a lot more than we ever used to, which I guess is a testament to the character maturing and them wanting to give her more of an active role in some of these situations.
I agree with Nathan. I really appreciated that she was so effective. She gets right in there. She's quiet. She sneaks right up on him, and he's done. And that's kind of how a Jedi would do it. And we get to see her maturing. We get to see her growing and obtaining these skills and applying them effectively. And I feel like that was really a valuable thing to see, because we're supposed to be assuming that she's growing up, that she's learning, and if she's always ineffective, it wouldn't really work.
So then Anakin and Ahsoka play unintentionally a little good cop, bad cop, but they eventually get Anakin, I guess even Dinar at this point, is freaked out enough to admit what's going on, and then the colonists aren't there.
A lightsaber to your throat will do that to you. But I gotta say, though, I think they handled the ending well, because in most cartoons, especially when you have demonstrative hero characters, as opposed to being, you know, sort of a group of characters, and who knows who will be the hero of this episode. In this case, in this situation, you know it's got to be Anakin or Ahsoka or probably Obi-Wan. Those are the only characters that really stand out as our options in that regard. We don't get the stereotypical cartoon thing of, as soon as Ahsoka or Anakin or whoever gets onto the bridge or gets up there into the cockpit so that they can, you know, switch everything off or whatever so that they can take out Dinar, you don't see them stand up and say, "Ha ha, you see? Your plan has failed. Surrender," or something like that. Instead, she sneaks over to turn things off. She's only caught because he happens to notice her, not because she does something that specifically draws his attention or tries to get his attention. They're playing on the stealth aspect here, which is not something that a lot of cartoons would do, unfortunately, even when it does feel appropriate. Heck, I don't even think the new G.I. Joe, that's supposed to at least have some small element of military tactics to it, tends to use very much in the way of the stealth stuff, unless they're playing around with Snake Eyes. So if they played it quite well compared to all the different pitfalls they could have fallen into for that last, you know, 90 seconds, 2-3 minutes, whatever it is.
Okay, so we wrap up the episode with Yularen reporting that they've done a scan of the planet and the colonists are nowhere to be found. And the Jedi Council get to the conclusion that there's Sith activity. Well, duh, aren't we established that Dooku Sith? Is that not clear? And I'm asking this question honestly here. I'm not being sarcastic. Is that not clear from Attack of the Clones, or that there's Sith involvement here? I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out how to place this in terms of what do they know when, but Dooku kind of spilled the beans there, didn't he?
I mean, yeah, they knew he was Sith. I don't know if at this point they know that there's two Sith, but they definitely know that, you know, Dooku is doing this. I don't know what the point of that obvious statement, you know, I guess in case anybody missed it, Yoda was just making sure they knew.
Well, I was thinking it was more like, you know, this could have just been a regular issue of slaving with the slavers, whatever. But that Yoda's essentially saying that there is a deeper motivation behind this. This isn't just Dooku doing this because this is about the war. There is some level of Sith plotting to this that goes deeper than what we realize. Which is funny because now Yoda notices it, and the fact that slavery makes a good tool for people like the Sith because it's sort of a dark side type of thing to do. And yet in situations where they throw like a volatile Jedi Master into the mix, like last week, no one is bringing up the obvious. This seems like it's possibly been orchestrated specifically for the darker angle this could take. You know, this time they notice it. Other times they don't.
So maybe next week Anakin will go, "Oh, sure, now you care about it."
Yeah, really? Slavery wasn't a big deal when it was just my mom.
I just hope we don't get one of those stereotypical things that thankfully they avoided in the comics, which would be something where he's beating up on a slaver and he's like, "And this is for my mom!" You know, he's just beating on him.
"I don't even know Shmi Skywalker. What are you talking about?"
Well, what would be interesting, I don't think they'll do this based because I know they didn't do it in the comic book. If Gardula lost Anakin and Shmi to Watto, but who did she get him from? Wouldn't it be interesting if it came out in the next episode that the Zygerians are the ones who actually sold Anakin and Shmi to Gardula?
Okay, I kind of like that, actually. That would be kind of interesting. Seems like maybe something they should have brought up before this point, but that's a neat twist. If I was looking for the twist at the end, that would have been it.
All that they've really said about it is that it was a group of pirates, basically, that wound up taking them, that they're on a family trip, basically. Shmi, when she's very, very young, I think she's like 6-7 years old. I mean, she's very young, younger than Anakin was when we meet him in The Phantom Menace. And the family ship winds up being taken, and the pirates sell them into slavery. So with those pirates essentially being unnamed up to this point, that'd be an awesome thing to make it so that the Zygerians are the ones behind that. Even if it was something like where Anakin just kind of has an instinctive memory, perhaps through his mother, just a sense that these people have something to do with my family's past, that would give him more of a motivation to have had such an extreme angry reaction rather than you know, the other theories we put forth as to why it would be quite so extreme. That'd be very cool to see.
All right, great discussion, guys. Let's get into some of our voicemails this week. We have four to go through this week, and let's get started.
Hi, Republic Forces Radio Network. It's Robert Darth Ikari calling in with my thoughts on the latest episode of Clone Wars Kidnapped. It was a pretty solid episode. Obviously, nowhere near the level of awesome that we had with our last arc, but it still maintains potential to go somewhere pretty cool. One little thing to mention, though, I think that if the people making the Clone Wars action figures were to follow the pattern that the Hasbro used to use for the old Batman line, we could now have our punching bag Obi-Wan figure. So it was kind of interesting. It's like as I was watching both Anakin and Obi-Wan when they were on their bark speeders, you know, in a little action sequence at the beginning of the episode, the fact that I was thinking, huh, isn't it kind of interesting how the fact is that their hair actually kind of moves a little bit. And then, of course, you know, later on when Obi-Wan's getting the crud kicked out of him, he's got the little lock of hair that's fallen across his face. So it's like they've added one extra point of articulation to his character model. But, of course, still his beard is still as solid as ever. But it was kind of a nice little ploy that he had just to allow himself to get, you know, thrown all around the room until the time was right. The bomb thing kind of felt a little video game-ish. I'm going to actually have to go back and refresh my memory if that was a plot point in the original comic. I don't quite remember it, but it's been a while since I read that one. I did enjoy the little bits of interplay between Anakin and Ahsoka, though, and it was really something to see just how quickly Anakin was snapping off. I mean, just from the very moment that he saw that it was a Zygarian, you know, when we saw that trailer for season four, I didn't understand what in the world that little blue glowing thing that Anakin, you know, smashes in his hand was. At first, I thought it was sort of a weird blue glowing gun. But then when we find out that he actually just ripped the communicator out of Commander Cody's hand, that was kind of entertaining. But yeah, that moment there towards the end of the episode where Anakin's got his lightsaber held right up against his, you know, the slaver's throat, you could really see that, you know, what the heck are you doing expression on Ahsoka's face. It was kind of cool to see that. It'll be interesting to see how far he goes through the rest of this these upcoming episodes. But obviously, the quality is still very good, it was a kind of a straightforward episode this time around, but we'll see where they go to from here. Awful lot of new character models, though, for the Togrutans. It's like I vaguely remember how different the headtails looked in the comic, but they really kind of explored different styles for them for the rest, you know, especially for the males where the horns kind of sweep forward instead of sweeping back like they are on most of the female characters. So, all right, well, we'll see what happens next week, and I'll be calling in with my thoughts on it. Have a good one, everyone. Bye.
Thanks for the call there. And, you know, I think we hit on a lot of those same points, punching bag Obi-Wan. Hey, that's a figure I'd buy.
If they make a punching bag Obi-Wan, it's got to have a voice chip.
Ow, quit kicking me. Yeah. But you know what? This episode did bring us some interesting visuals. I wanted to kind of touch on that point. The moving hair. Also, the added character models. Yeah, we have essentially two new designs between the Sigurians and the Togrutans. So a lot going on visually in this episode. How did all this work for you guys in terms of these models and just the fact that, hey, even the existing models, Obi-Wan, Anakin, even they're getting more fluid, more animated. What are you guys thinking?
I love how it's just the little details that bring everything together. The thing that I notice is during the speeder chase or speeder battle is the beads on Ahsoka's head were flapping. And I'm not sure if I've ever noticed that before, but just it's little subtle details that sort of bring the sense of realism and this animation to a whole new level for me.
They're getting much better at just mimicking human motion, too. Like, there were a lot of scenes in the first couple of seasons, especially the first season. I think everyone remembers in Bombad Jedi when Padme runs across that bridge, and it was just so stilted and wooden. It looked awful. And a lot of the movements in this season, and last season to a degree, are much more fluid, much more real. I don't know if they're doing something different. I don't think they're doing any kind of motion capture, but maybe they're just referencing things better or they have better technology. But they look more realistic. The stilted, really awkward motion seems to have been pretty much removed from all of this now. It's really impressive how far they've come in just a couple of years.
Growing up, another thing that he said about the whole idea that the bombs felt very gamerish. Yeah, they're from the comics, but I'm right there on the whole gamerish thing. I think because it feels like it's just run to it, and as soon as you get to it, it's okay, it's done. Go to the next one, go to the next one. Any of the kind of suspense that you would expect from a you must defuse the bombs type of storyline is gone when instead of having to open it up and actually defuse anything, it's don't worry about it, just one quick slice with your lightsaber, and everything's fine. Anakin does it here, Ahsoka comes up with it in the comics, but it's just kind of one of those, really? You have this sophisticated bomb, and one slash across the wires, that's it? I mean, Jack Bauer must be crying somewhere.
You know, what was weird about that was that even Ahsoka was commenting, hey, how'd you know that was going to work? And Anakin said, well, it was an educated guess. Based on what? What knowledge did you have of this bomb to just say, oh, just slash through and be fine? Where you got your suspense, though, was on the final one. And, hey, they're synced together. We have to do them simultaneously. But we need a moment. I guess ultimately they really didn't. But the snipers come out and pin them down to where they just can't do it in sync. Turns out it only took them a split second. I think they could have actually done that and bypassed the snipers and not even necessarily had to have taken them out. But yeah, I see what you're saying. It is just the find the 10 spots on the map, press up, up, down, down, X, X, Y, Y, and it'll be gone.
With that last pair of bombs, what would have been more tension building is if when Ahsoka lifted off the access panel, it had started a countdown on both of them. And they had to get out from under the guns of the droids in time to, you know, slice them before they went.
Or if maybe they were concerned that the blast from the snipers could set off the bombs, you know, that they were finding to sort of deflect it so the blasts don't hit the bombs themselves, and you're just waiting to see at what point will the droids figure this out and start actually aiming at the bombs instead of at Anakin or Ahsoka. Anything like that could have added some tension to it.
All right, let's move on to our next voicemail.
Hi, RFRN. It's
Hey, everyone at RFRN. This is Ben, a.k.a. Devis on the forums, calling in about was this one? I think it was Kidnapped. I want to say it was Slaves of the Republic, but I think that's the next episode. Anyway, to start off, it was nice to see that Obi-Wan's hair actually wasn't carved out of wood. Well, namely because in past seasons, and I guess namely in the Clone Wars movie, it, like with some characters, especially Dooku, it looked like their hair or their facial hair was just like a big block of wood. But anyway, that's just a candid observation. Okay, the three biggest things, or most important things, that I took away from this episode was, one, it didn't have that same feel like Darkness on Umbara did, and I know it's a mistake to compare the two. I mean, they're two obviously entirely different episodes to entirely different storylines, but you know, it just didn't have that same feel. And part of my fear for this episode, or maybe even this arc, is they're gonna do what I think it was Jen predicted, that they're just gonna, you know, they're gonna brush the whole Umbara arc under the rug. Have Rex carry on like he was before, you know, like no mention or anything. And they could have had a brief mention when Obi-Wan talked to Boyle briefly. I mean, he could have said something about Waxer there, but they chose not to. So I really hope that, you know, the whole event on Umbara doesn't get pushed aside, but maybe it will. Two, Darth Dinar. Zygerian slaver. I really like this character. I mean, he seems pretty vicious from what we saw. I mean, just the beatdown that he gave Obi-Wan, which you'd think that Obi-Wan would have more more bruises or maybe even broken bones, because he got his butt pretty well handed to him. And I know they can't show a whole lot, being a quote-unquote kid's show, but, I mean, I feel there should have been a lot more on Obi-Wan damage-wise than what we saw. Anyway, back to Dinar. I mean, I really hope they don't reveal him to be this pathetic character at the end of this arc or throughout this arc, because I like this character. He's part of me, I guess, expected him to say at some point to Obi-Wan the age-old Dracula line, like, "I want to suck your blood," because he just sounded like that to me. I pictured that in my mind, like, every time he spoke. But I guess the question of this voicemail to whoever is on call, actually, I might have two parts. Was his weapon a light whip? Because we finally get to see the scene from the trailer, like, back in at the end of season 3, of him twirling that around, you know. I mean, and I don't know, it looked pretty interesting from the few scenes they had, and I wish they would have focused more on him and Ahsoka rather than Anakin fighting whatever that beast was. But there is the question: was that a light whip? And part two of it: if that was, does this mean that they're going to bring more EU technology, I suppose, into the Clone Wars? Because the only two other times that I know of the light whip appearing is in the first Darth Bane novel, and with Luke's eventual opponent, like Lumaya or the Dark Lady, whatever she was called. So that looks pretty interesting. I want to see more of that. And third and lastly, the moral, or the fortune cookie, as Barrett says, from time to time. I think it was, here, I have it written down somewhere. I can't find it. I won't waste time looking for it. But, like, where you came from shows where you're going, or something to that line. That's very, very applicable to Anakin as a whole, because, you know, he came into all of this as a slave. Maybe you could argue that he was a slave of the Jedi. I'm not entirely sure on that, but he goes right into being a slave of Palpatine or Sidious. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Had a nice hidden meaning there for any who care to look for it. But other than that, I look forward to seeing how this arc plays out, and I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode. Thanks. Take care, guys. Bye.
Two things kind of spring to mind here. One, to take that whole, you know, where you come from determines where you're going, or however it is that they say that for the fortune cookie, also sort of fits the idea that, you know, they hint at the idea that Anakin is created by the Sith somehow manipulating the midichlorians. And the EU, every great once in a while, has glanced against this and sort of confirmed that the Sith engineered Anakin, in a sense here. That's why you've got that whole parthenogenesis, virgin birth kind of thing going on. So in a sense, created by the Sith becomes a Sith, although he does get redeemed very briefly there in the end. I'm hoping that upcoming Darth Plagueis novel is going to reveal more about the whole backstory there. But to the specific question that was asked about the light whip, and does this mean more EU coming into the show? They grab from the EU from time to time anyway. Whether they acknowledge it is a big question. I mean, they acknowledge on the Blu-rays that, or I guess the DVDs too, in the featurettes, that the holocrons were originally in other Star Wars media, which to us means expanded universe. On the other hand, they completely ignore Dave Wolverton in anything having to do with the fact that he created Dathomir, he created the idea of the Night Sisters and all this kind of stuff ahead of time. The only stuff that wasn't something that he developed for that initial culture, at least, was the look of the modern Night Sisters coming from Episode 1 concept art. They completely ignore him. But for the most part, it seems like they are somewhat EU-friendly, at least when it comes to tech and other things. I mean, heck, technically this story in and of itself was expanded universe material, albeit just Clone Wars cartoon spinoff material that doesn't tend to affect much of anything else around it. But that was not a light whip, so we can't really take too much from that. It's an electro whip, according to the episode guide on StarWars.com, instead of a light whip. The light whip, though, I mean, for what it's worth, was used more than for just Lumaya, the Dark Lady of the Sith from the Marvel and Legacy of the Force days, and for Githany, who I think you were referencing there, in Jedi vs. Sith and the Darth Bane materials. We see them in the Coruscant Knights books, the Jedi Apprentice series, the Empire at War Forces of Corruption video game, the Cestus Deception, in the pages of anthology comics like Star Wars Tales and Clone Wars Adventures. So it's not a particularly novel weapon anymore, albeit rarer than, say, a lightsaber, of course. It's been suggested within some of the EU source materials, actually, that they've been retroactively going back and giving that light whip name to some earlier stuff, like the weapon that's seen in the droids episode Across the Ruined Sea, which you could have heard in our summer material, I guess 2 years ago now, and that said that that one's a light whip too. So it's previously appeared in Star Wars cartoon form, even if it wasn't given the name at the time. The electro whip idea that we see here, that's more of like a physical whip that happens to be electrified, seems a lot more like what we see in the EU as a so-called shock whip, which it's kind of similar. It was first introduced for a Quarren Sith known as Darth Malaval, who was introduced and then subsequently killed off very quickly in the fourth issue of Star Wars Legacy, set in 137 ABY, well over a century and a half after the Clone Wars itself. So there is precedent for the weapon, but it's not a light whip, and maybe we shouldn't take anything out of that other than just they like the general concept. I'm assuming, you know, it's like the old thing, everybody puts a steering wheel in a car, but no one says the steering wheel was their invention. It's a familiar concept, so whether they based it on something previously or not is up in the air. It certainly harkens back to things, though.
All right, thanks, Nathan. Let's go to our next voicemail.
Hi, it's Dominic Yo. I am Wolf General on the forums, and I would like to say that I really like this week's episode. First, I'd go over some things that I did not like or I felt kind of weird. I felt like Anakin's being mad about the slaver. I didn't really know who these slavers are for a casual fan. I was wondering if Nathan can clear that up in Continuity Corner about more about Anakin's relations with this species, because I was under the impression that Anakin was actually being slaved by the Hutts and not the Zygarians. So kind of confused about why he would be so angry. But, I mean, he might be angry because they're slavers, but I don't know why he would be, like, angry to the point where he would have, like, a Darth Vader moment at the end of the episode. Another thing I found strange was that about Anakin's joke about disarming the bomb. I mean, we know that Anakin is a good mechanic, and he probably should know something about bomb circuitry. So I found it weird how he didn't use his skills to disarm the bomb, because we all know this is a nod to episode one, how Anakin is a slave and all that. So why don't you take it one step further and say, oh, he knows how to work with the bombs, or he's worked with this piece before and he knows about the bomb. So I found it weird how he just slashes the bomb and they are disarmed. I thought they totally missed that opportunity to make a nod to the first film. As for things I really liked about this episode, I liked the level of facial expression. For some reason, I felt that the facial expression in this episode was a lot better than previous episodes. I liked how Obi-Wan's hair was not so static as it was in previous episodes, how it would move while he was fighting. I liked the Togrutas, how they were all, like, you can see the variety. They had different colors, they had different lengths of Legu and all that stuff. And especially at the end, I liked the part where Obi-Wan had bruises on his face. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And, like, the creatures, they were awesome looking. I mean, seriously, they had, like, that the tentacle one. I liked that one a lot. I was wondering if Nathan could point out all these creatures in Continuity Corner as well. And, again, I liked that Anakin's Darth Vader moment at the end, how he was threatening Slaver to stab him through the neck if he didn't tell him where the Togrutas were. That's it. See you guys later.
Okay. So this was our third voicemail in a row with comments about Obi-Wan's hair. So Obi-Wan, don't know what you're doing with that hair, but keep it up. Nathan, any comments on the question he had?
Well, as far as the creatures go, I really wasn't paying all that much attention to the creatures. I know the Blixus finally got a name, although Henry Gilroy apparently was tossing that out a few times previously, just not in the actual comic this is based on. And we have the Convor, which is that little bird kind of pet that he had, which is also a creature that was used in Padawan Lost, I guess at the end of last season. Beyond that, I really wasn't paying all that much attention to the creatures. I can offer an answer though on the Zygerians. Anakin has this anger against slavers and slavery in general, not necessarily Zygerians, unless there's something they're going to work into these next two episodes that hasn't appeared before, even in the comic. The Zygerians were first really kind of fleshed out and given center stage in the comics that this episode is based on, but they've been around for quite a while. In fact, they've been retconned to have been the identity of a character named Mark Tyne in the old Marvel comic issue Return of the Hunter that featured Valance way back when. They showed up in the RPG quite a bit, but never really got much in-depth screen time, so to speak, despite being mentioned in the very first Star Wars source book back in 1987. They were guides, or I guess expanded on, in a couple of the Galaxy Guides for the role-playing game, the West End Games one. They even got a brief mention in Heir to the Empire, the first modern EU novel back in 91. But they really only got any sort of big attention, as opposed to just being little source book nod type of things, at least before 2008, from Jason Fry, who wrote a Wizards of the Coast RPG adventure that used them, along with a later mission that replayed bits of that same Marvel issue, and that was where they introduced that whole, well, Marco Tyne, he's now a Zygerian. And frankly, one of the things this has brought up is the jury's still kind of out on the exact nature of how this species looks, because the comics that this is based on, at least, gave them red hair and bony spikes on more than just their chins. The cartoon makes them look a lot more bat-like, or I guess as Jerry would say, Wolverine-like, with fur more than hair, and the Marco Tyne character from so long ago that has been retconned to be this species looks nothing like either of those interpretations of the species. My guess is that what we're going to wind up having is they're going to tell us this is just a broad species with multiple subspecies. Somewhere that retcon's probably going to come in, like they did with the Aqualish and such. So it'll be interesting to see where this species, I guess you could say, goes from here.
Well, as far as the Zygerians, I was hugely into the West End games from 87 on. I had a game group in junior high, high school, and in college, and actually we played a couple of adventures drawing on the information that was presented for Zygerians. We had one whole campaign that centered around them, so I've always kind of liked the idea of that type of character in the Star Wars universe. It makes sense, and especially since it was established in episode one that the slave trade existed outside the Republic. You know, it kind of makes sense to me that there would be a species or an organization, because I think it was a guild that would capitalize on that.
You know, I pretty much ignored them from the RPG days. I mean, they were just kind of one of those things that get referenced and then left. But I didn't really play the RPG. I just flipped through the source books for material for the timeline and such. So I got to ask, I mean, granted, they showed up in the comics first. So when you saw them in the comics and then now that you've seen them on the series, do either of those looks really fit with what you expected, having played the RPG with them quite a bit?
Well, the way we played them was completely different. I don't think they ever gave statistics that I remember, or at least what we played in. So we described them as the Breen from Star Trek, you know, with the huge helmets. I'm not sure if I'm throwing something out there and probably
the ones that look like knockoffs of Bush.
Yes. That's how we kind of played them. So I didn't really have a problem, because I knew that anything I played certainly was as far from continuity as you could get.
All right, now for our last voicemail.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Madeline, leaving, you know, my voicemail. Last night's episode, Kidnapped, it was just amazing. It was just so incredible, the way that, I loved all the acting, all the effects. I was really glad to see Anakin again after all this crazy stuff with General Krell. I was just, like, so happy and excited. But it's crazy because it reminds me so much of this comic I read called Slaves of the Republic by Henry Gilroy, I think. Same storyline, same people, same everything. Like, I even knew some of the lines before the characters said them. It was crazy. But just overall, just totally loved it. It was totally epic. And love you guys, love the show, and keep up the good work. Bye.
You know, I do have to ask one question. Why are some issues of a comic being adapted in this purpose? I mean, I guess we've seen it now twice, given the opening episode for the Citadel. What leads them to that? Why do they do that? You know, how do they make the decisions of which ones to use, which one to adapt? What kind of insight do we have on that?
both times they've done this, and we'll get into this in Continuity Corner, but both times they've done this, it's been something written by Henry Gilroy. And the first time it was an idea that was come up with for the Malevolence trilogy, but then they didn't use it. That's the whole thing from the Citadel arc with the carbon freezing. And then they wind up using this instance where they're actually pulling a full story in there. So you got to wonder if maybe this was something that was considered for the show and then tossed or what, because Gilroy has said that that original idea that wound up in Shipyards of Doom, he came up with for the show, but they couldn't use it, so they turned it into a comic. Here, it's a full comic basically being turned into an episode, but you got to wonder if this is another issue of this was abandoned, oh, well, now we want to come back to it. But I don't think they would have done it if it was going to be written by anybody other than Gilroy himself, because Gilroy obviously is going to be good at adapting this for the screen because he's written for the show already.
Well, Nathan, I think that's a good segue into Continuity Corner.
All right, folks, this will be a somewhat detailed Continuity Corner these next couple of weeks, plus this week, because, of course, this episode is based on an original comic book. So, the original story for this episode comes from Henry Gilroy, who was the head writer for Season 1 of The Clone Wars and wrote Bombad Jedi, Lair of Grievous, Innocence of Ryloth, and Liberty on Ryloth, though I don't think we should hold Bombad Jedi against him. This story first appeared as Slaves of the Republic, which was the comic book story arc name, as it is also next week's cartoon episode name, as 6 issues of Dark Horse Comics' The Clone Wars comic series, which was originally intended to be an ongoing series, but it has ended since then. Both the first issue of this comic story, entitled The Mystery of Kyros, and the other comic story that Gilroy wrote that had major elements brought into the cartoon series, Shipyards of Doom, with its carbonite freezing and Ahsoka violating orders to tag along on a mission behind enemy lines, both actually predate the cartoon series, as they were released in the gap between the August 2008 release of the Clone Wars film and the October 2008 premiere of the cartoon series itself. The first issue was released on September 10th of 2008. This episode of the cartoon, Kidnapped, is sort of a condensed and retooled version of the first 2 issues of the comic storyline, The Mystery of Kyros and Slave Traders of Zygeria. The first scene, featuring the conversation between Yoda and Roshdi, the Togruta leader, is very close to its comic version, featuring nearly identical dialogue preceded by Roshdi giving background on the planet, much like the opening newsreel voice does in the cartoon. The conversation between Dooku and Roshdi that follows features abbreviated dialogue from the comic, leaving out the reason for why Dooku ostensibly wants to take over Kyros, that he has intelligence that says that the Republic plans to establish a stronghold on Kyros. Also of note in the scene is that Dooku arrives in his solar sailor alone, while the transports arrive at other landing sites, presumably bearing the commander of the operation. No tactical droid, like the unnamed one in the cartoon, is present in the storyline. It might also be of note that while Roshdi reluctantly thanks Dooku in the cartoon, his last comic line is, "What choice do I have?" since we cannot infer anything by tone of voice in a comic. In the comic, 19 rotations, rather than 10, pass before the Republic forces engage battle droids on Kyros. In the comic, we do not see the actual ships arrive in space, but instead jump right into the battle. In the cartoon, we see several ships arrive, including a Venator Star Destroyer, but not an Acclimator Assault Ship, but then it's an Acclimator that actually arrives on the planet, unless my eyes deceive me. Perhaps it was just off-screen when the other ships arrived in orbit. The Bark Speeder versus Droids battle is much more elaborate on screen than it is in the comic. The comic lacks any enemy speeders or commando droids, instead focusing on regular B1 battle droids and super battle droids, along with a final line of armored assault tanks, AATs. Contrary to the comments of some fans on various forums who are decrying that it is Rex, not Cody, sitting in Obi-Wan's sidecar, that is not original to the cartoon. That actually comes from the comic, where Anakin is with Ahsoka and Obi-Wan is with Rex, just like in this cartoon episode. This would also be a good time to note that the story in the comic is set early in the Clone Wars, during the time when our characters are in their original costumes and Ahsoka is still 14 years old. Thus, Ahsoka will use only one lightsaber at any point in this story. She doesn't have her Shoto yet. Another interesting tidbit about this battle. In the comic, the Jedi banter about keeping score of takedowns, which sort of fits with what we see with Rex's armor with the little tally marks now, suggesting that one destroyer droid is worth 5 super battle droids, and one super battle droid is worth 5 regular battle droids. Rex then uses the rocket launcher to blast through the tanks, as he does in the cartoon, and asks, "How would you score a couple of tanks, General?" To which Obi-Wan replies, "Let's just say that puts you in the lead, Captain." The banter in the cartoon, while on the speeders, deals with the question of where everyone has gone, whereas that conversation, mixed with some more regret from Ahsoka over the damage to a home for her people, takes place after the battle in the comic. It's also bitterly ironic in the comic when the clone who reports on any other droid activity around that point is acknowledged by Obi-Wan as Waxer, who of course died in the last episode of the cartoon, Carnage of Krell. This was Waxer's first appearance, predating seeing him in the show. In the cartoon, the reporting clone is on a walker and is Boyle, Waxer's old buddy who, according to Leland Chi, shares the distinction of having a Numa image on his helmet with Waxer. That was a point of continuity brought up in the last episode of Republic Forces Radio Network. Apparently, yes, they both have them. Oh, and yes, it was Waxer in the image notifying Krell about the captured gear last episode. Your guess is as good as mine as to how that works out logically. But back to this episode. A major shift comes when Obi-Wan is contacted by the leader of the slavers in the cartoon, Dartz Dinar, a Zygerian. In the cartoon, Anakin reacts with anger at seeing a Zygerian, knowing that they're known as slavers. He then holds that anger as the story progresses through disabling the thermal annihilator bombs around the colony. In the comic, Obi-Wan is given a message via a clone that the leader of the invaders wants to speak with him. But that leader is not a Zygerian himself, but is instead a Besalisk, like Dexter Jester or Pong Krell, named Zirius Ugg, UGG, who works for the Separatists, not the Zygerian Slave Empire or Zygerian Slavers Guild. Obviously, this also means that the conversation between Obi-Wan and Ahsoka about Anakin's slave past must come later as well. So, Obi-Wan meets with Dartz in the cartoon or Ugg in the comic. In both cases, Obi-Wan tries to get the leader to surrender, but then learns about the bombs, which Anakin and the others hear about through an open comm line. R2 then scans for the bombs while Obi-Wan buys them some time. Whereas in the cartoon, Obi-Wan appeals to Dart's Zygerian background and traditional one-on-one, hand-to-hand combat. In the comic, Obi-Wan refuses to surrender and knows that Ugg wants a one-on-one fight, but is constrained by the fact that Dooku pays a bonus for Jedi who simply surrender. Obi-Wan goads him into a fight with similar terms to the cartoon. If Obi-Wan loses, Ugg must lead them to the Togruta, and if Ugg wins, Obi-Wan must surrender. While Obi-Wan fights against Dartz in the episode, pretending to have the disadvantage in the cartoon, and while Obi-Wan battles Ugg in what appears to be an actual fight that Obi-Wan has a slight advantage in by the end in the comic, Anakin and Ahsoka race out to deactivate the bombs. As in the cartoon, the bombs are deactivated by a lightsaber slash through their wiring, but it is Ahsoka, not Anakin, who comes up with the idea in the comic. They are also then set upon by sniper fire, but in the comic, it's just a destroyer droid, not a new variation on that theme, the sniper or sharpshooter droid as seen in the cartoon. The sniper in the comic is also alone, rather than one of a pair, and is taken out by a sniper shot fired by Rex from atop a nearby building, rather than by the Jedi sending the droid's own blasts on a return course. In both the comic and the cartoon, a battle droid reports via hologram that the bombs have been disabled, and the enemy leader tries to set off any remaining bombs. In the cartoon, this results in nothing, and Obi-Wan reveals his ruse to buy time. In the comic, Obi-Wan takes advantage of the distraction caused by the droid's report to turn the tables on Ugg, and when Ugg tries to blow up any remaining bombs, there is indeed an explosion, aboard his own ship, where Anakin and Ahsoka had put one of the bombs. This is the point where the plots of the comic and cartoon start to shift and cover similar ground in rather different ways. Rather than having the enemy leader on Kira's escape to his ship, as Dartz Dinar does to his Takora in the cartoon, Obi-Wan in the comic tosses Ugg through the glass of the tower window and down onto the ground below. He refuses to tell Obi-Wan anything about the plan, despite their earlier wager, but Obi-Wan is able to determine by analyzing Ugg's transmitter records that he was in contact with someone in the Zygerian system, which finally introduces the Zygerian and slaving elements into the storyline. Whereas Admiral Yularen will report on the lack of any Togruta on Kira's at the end of the cartoon episode, he does so at this point in the comic. The second issue of the comic, Slave Traders of Zygeria, begins in a briefing much like the one at the end of Kidnapped, and it is in this setting where we learn of the background of the Zygerian slave empire being crushed by the Jedi, and see Anakin's hostile reaction to slavery, prompting Obi-Wan to tell Ahsoka that Anakin was once a slave, a conversation had in the cartoon on Kyros. In the cartoon, Anakin, Ahsoka, and Obi-Wan race after the T'Kora as Darts tries to escape. They leap aboard, fight off the tentacled Blixus, then capture him, learning from him that the Togruta are on their way to a slave auction on Zygeria. In the comics, our heroes have already left Kyros, and Ugg, who was not a Zygerian, has been defeated. They need a different way to find the Togruta. They head for the asteroid field left from the destruction of the Shikar homeworld, where they board a Zygerian slaver's ship under the guise of being spice dealers. They engage the Zygerians aboard, who are under the command of a one-eyed, or at least eye-patched, Captain Onyx. The Zygerians drive off the Jedi and clones while capturing Ahsoka. The Jedi capture a few Zygerians, though, along the way, and they arrange to trade the Zygerians for Ahsoka. But Ahsoka, held captive on the bridge, uses the Force to flip an airlock switch, allowing Anakin and Obi-Wan to board in EVA suits, after dealing with the pesky tentacled creature that is released when the airlock is opened, presumably a Blixus like the one in the cartoon. Upon taking over the Zygerian ship, they then question Onyx, who reveals that there are rumors that the Togruta will be at a slave auction on Zygeria, and it is by invitation only. Onyx, and now our heroes, just happens to have an invitation to the auction. Anakin suggests that they infiltrate the auction with Ahsoka posing as his slave, which sets in motion the events seen in the next issues of the comic, similar events to those in the next episode of the cartoon, and of course, the skankiest, most inappropriate outfit ever worn by 14-year-old Ahsoka in the comics, which has, fortunately, been changed for the cartoon, as we'll see next week. So about the first 75% of this episode is very similar, though not identical, to the first issue of the comic, and the last, 25% or so of the cartoon is a very condensed, shifted location version of the second issue of the comic. That leaves us with 2 cartoon episodes to go in this storyline, and 4 issues of the comic. And that rounds out Continuity Corner this time around.
Alright guys, well first we want to thank all of our callers and everyone who sent in voicemails. Remember, if you have a voicemail for future episodes, make sure to call our voicemail at 415-508-JEDI. That's 415-508-5334. Or you can send an MP3 to show@republicforces.com and your voicemail may actually be played on the air. So guys, thanks for joining me this week, and I guess we will see you next time for Slaves of the Republic. Good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Barrent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a production of Venganza Media Incorporated, copyright 2011, all rights reserved.